You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Martha Conway is the author of The Physician's Daughter, The Underground River, Sugarland, Thieving Forest, and 12 Bliss Street. Her new novel is We Meet Apart. Thank you for joining me, Martha.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
You are well known for writing historical novels, and this is yet another historical novel, but you include an interesting twist in it. So I'd like you to describe, briefly what to you as the writer the twist was, and also when you came up with it in the process of writing the book. Was it part of the original premise, or did it just happen that that was the easiest way for you to tell this particular story?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was not part of the premise. I started writing the manuscript literally the day lockdown was ordered in San Francisco. And I had a very different idea of what was going to happen in the book. And as I wrote it, like everyone, I was feeling, apart from the world. And as I kept writing it, the story of this one young woman who was trapped in Ireland in 1940 during World War II, an American woman who was trapped there, I kept feeling like something was missing. It wasn't quite going right. And sort of as an afterthought, I had at some point written about her sister. And when I was talking to a couple of people, friends I know, writers, and my husband and my children, I kept saying, like, what could I do differently? What could I do to get this, get a little zhuzh into the storyline? And somebody, I think it was my daughter, suggested a ghost. And I thought, oh, that's good. And then my husband said, and maybe the ghost doesn't know she's a ghost. And I thought, oh, that's really good. So kind of a year into the process, I went back and I started building up these two different stories, these two different realities in which there are two sisters, both of whom think the other one has died. And this is not giving away anything because you learn this right in the beginning. They both think the other one has died, but they're actually sort of existing in two different realities, and they can come together and see each other just for an hour at dusk.
You know, one of the things that I really, this book made me think about was the bardo.
That's a compliment.
The bardo is often thought of as the other world, essentially, a kind of a Buddhist purgatory, but it's also used to describe this world, and that, we are in preparation for whatever the afterlife is, whatever that means. So I think one of the things that I really liked about this book was the way that you it made you think about the bardo and our existence here. So talk about creating the alternate history that these two sisters, there's Gabby, who lives in the history we're familiar with, and Sabine, who lives in the history we're unfamiliar with. I have to say that you wrote the alternate history so convincingly, I had to look it up. Even though I knew that it was not the case, it was so well written, I had to look it up. So talk about creating the alternate history and using that as a reflection of the storyline in history we're familiar with.
Yeah, sure. Well, while I was doing a lot of research about Ireland during the Second World War, and this was before I decided that there would be two sort of alternate realities, I learned that the Germans had, in fact, had a plan, a very elaborate plan to invade Ireland. They called it Operation Green. And their idea was that after they conquered France, they would just use French boats, skip over to Ireland and invade England from there. And this did not happen for a variety of reasons. For one thing, the French didn't have the boats that the Germans thought they had. But when I decided, maybe there's a ghost, maybe she doesn't know she's a ghost, I remembered this plan and thought, well, there's my blueprint, right? It was extremely organized and thought out. And so I could just use that blueprint for my alternate history. And of course, also using stories from Poland and Norway and Denmark and other places that the Nazis took over and ruled and what it was like for the people there.
You know, using the alternate history as part of your storytelling in this novel was really interesting. I love it's an element of the fantastic, and I love fiction that incorporates elements of the fantastic, because what it allows you to do is to externalize things that don't happen in reality and then turn them into plot points so that, you know, Dracula is a vampire, but he's also representative of something that exists in all of us, and so on and so forth throughout the history of supernatural and even science fiction literature. War of the Worlds was written in a sense as a look at English, conquests and how badly they treated the people there. So I'd like to talk about using the element of the fantastic to create the tension between these two storylines, and also to, you know, bring out the real frictions that exist in the world. For example, the friction between the Irish and the English, who, you know, the Irish were used to being invaded by the English, and many of them, you have your characters think, well, I'd rather have the Germans than the English, some of them at least.
Yeah, that's right. It was very divided. And that was another thing that drew me to this particular place in time was that, you know, nowadays it seems very clear cut in World War II who is the bad guy and who is the good guy. But in Ireland in 1940, because of their history with the English, to some of them, it wasn't so clear cut who was the bad guy and who was the good guy. And there's this element of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which is worth exploring, you know, not necessarily true, but not necessarily false either. So, and then there was something that you just said that made me think of a Joseph Campbell quote, and I'm not going to get this exactly right, but he said something like the jungle or the exotic environment is a rich, how did he put it? It's a rich metaphor for the unconscious. So you can use this sort of other world to explore a character's conscious or unconscious views about life. And in both of these worlds, you have these two sisters who lost their parents and who in the beginning at least think that they've lost each other as well. And they're grieving, and they both have two very different forms of grief, which I was sort of interested in exploring as well. One, Sabine is very angry, and Gabby is very so sad that she really is almost stuck. And I think that there are so many different ways to grieve, and I was interested in exploring all of that as well.
One of the great utilities of the choice you've made to have these two sisters in other realities is you can have their narratives reflect one another, what's going on. And so it becomes something of a page turner. As you were reading Gabby's story, you say, well, what the heck is Sabine's going to happen to Sabine in the same world? And I thought that was a very interesting decision. Once you figured this up that you're going to use the two things. Did you have a kind of like a ladder of storytelling in some kind of note form?
I had definite scenes that I could see up ahead that I wanted to write. And I was so nervous because I did not see how it was going to end exactly. You can't live in the past, you know, all the time, the way Gabby sort of wants to. And moving forward for Sabine is a little dangerous. So I really, and are they going to stay together forever? And what does that look like? Are they going to be able to meet together forever? So I had some ideas of what was going to happen, but the story itself sort of, you know, once you write a scene, then you sort of understand what the next scene has to be and the next scene has to be. It's that old quote about, you know, you can only see as far as your headlights at night, but you can drive across the country that way. I definitely experienced that.
One of the things that is interesting to me is, you know, creating the characters in the two realities, because you really like both, you know, all the people you meet in both realities are, you know, pretty interesting and compelling, whether no matter what side they're on. So talk about creating characters in our reality. And you've written quite a bit of historical fiction, and talk about researching, you've talked a little bit about this, but also about researching a history that did not unfold.
Yeah, that was fun, actually, because when you're writing historical fiction or any fiction, right, you can pick and choose what you want to include. And I was sort of picking and choosing, you know, ideas in my mind, my imagination, bits of imaginary details that I wanted to include. And what would the, and just as you said before, what would those details, what would those, that setting and that plot, what would that mean to the characters who are living through it? So it was very similar in that, from my previous books, in that I read a lot of firsthand accounts and memoirs and travel journals, because I get inspired by details I read about, especially true details. And that sort of helps me envision a scene, you know, for my own particular characters. So I did a lot of that. And then if I got stuck, I could just sort of make something up because it wasn't a real reality anyway. And that was fun.
One of the things that I think makes this book so compelling and wonderful to read are the details that you mentioned and the historical details. And it's interesting, as I read, you know, the parts in the alternate history, I thought, wow, this just feels very real, and which I'm sure is what you are aiming for. Talk about, you know, using those details and also not overwhelming, because one of the things that is nice about this book is it's compact, it's direct, it feels very direct and to the point. And you know, it's, I would imagine that as you're researching this, you're reading 10 times as much as you actually end up writing. And so a lot of stuff has to go in the bin. How do you make decision which stuff to bin and which stuff to keep?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is a lot of stuff in the bin. I'll give you a specific example. There's one scene in which Sabine, who's in the world where the Nazis have invaded Ireland and have ruled it, I read an account of a woman who was executed for some act of sabotage. I think this was in Poland. And it was a very compelling account of exactly what the Nazis did to sort of do it publicly and to humiliate her. But she was also very strong, and she sort of refused to be humiliated. And I I kind of wanted to put that in as just an example of how dangerous this situation really was. And at the end of it, in my written scene, I have one of the, you know, there are a lot of Irish people who have gathered to witness this execution. And when everything is said and done, and the soldiers go away, one of the Irish women who live in the village turn around and she spits at Gabby's, the feet of Gabby's coworker, because she's a housemaid in this mansion where the Nazis are occupying. So she's sort of working for the Nazis in this way as a housemaid, as is Sabine. And for me, the compelling scene that I want to write about has to have a personal consequence for somebody that is actually in a character in the book. So you get to see how different people view what is going on. And not only the consequences, the potential consequences for Sabine, the danger, but also how people around them feel about, you know, the fact that they're working for the Nazis.
You know, when you have two timelines like this that are playing off of one another, one of the things that you can do with each timeline, and you do this extremely well, is to show us the same facts from different human perspectives. And I think the human part, you use that really well to describe the way that relationships in your other world are related, as it were, to the relationships in this world. And once again, this has brought for me the thought of, you know, this world as the bardo, the other world as the bardo, where we cleanse our souls and spirits to come out, you know, of this life ahead of where we might were when we started.
That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. Yeah. I can see that.
So I talk about using, you know, that parallax view, because there's one of the things I really liked was the discussion of the manor house in the two different worlds. It's completely different, and I think it really provides a powerful and poignant view too, because we get to see something at its peak, but also mourn its passing at the same time. And I think that combination of joy at seeing something well done and melancholy at understanding total demise is something we have to live with now in this moment, as we, you know, experience joy and misery as things are, you know, erect and beautiful and demolished just as fast.
Yeah. I like to use setting as a character. I mean, I think all writers do. And the manor house definitely was a character in and of itself. Both Gabby and Sabine end up working there, and it's a sort of down and out, Downton Abbey kind of place that gets a little spit and polish when the Nazis decide to take it over and use it for their accommodations. But there is this sense of, you know, something of transition, of something being lost. And the secondary characters too that I use, you know, a lot of times Gabby and Sabine will see the same people in their different worlds. And obviously, they're doing very different things, because, you know, you're going to be doing one sort of thing if your country is a free country, and a different kind of thing if your country is an occupied country. So that was a little bit of a play with the reader, quite frankly, because the reader will know everything that's going on in both worlds, whereas the characters, you know, the idea is the characters only know their own world. So, yeah, there's a lot of, I think, subtext that I could get across by having different interpretations of both the setting and using secondary characters.
Was this planned? Or, I mean, when you created the secondary characters, possibly at the, you know, earlier in the writing process, did you think, okay, that now in this other world, this character, did you find yourselves having to track the two characters to make sure that the reader experiences the difference at the same time in the narrative?
Yeah, I did try to track that very carefully. Originally, I had the Nazis invade Ireland much later on in the novel, and it didn't really work in terms of, I think, underscoring the fact that there are these two different worlds. I didn't want that to really come as a surprise. I wanted that to be up front. I decided I should have that up front right away. And the second part of your question, I liked the idea that personality is sort of malleable. So somebody who we might think of as a bad guy in one world with just a slightly different set of circumstances might be not so bad in another world. So in other words, you know, without giving too much away, there are some people who are heroes in one world and not so much in the other, and vice versa.
That must have been fun to write, but also when you were saying that you thought that the Nazis would invade later in the novel, that sounds like a major change. Did you find yourself kind of like fighting with your own concepts and saying, no, this is good enough? No, it's not good enough. How do you know when to stop writing in one vein and go back and restart at the beginning?
Well, there's always a little voice in my head that's saying, really? Really? and in this particular instance, it was sort of a fight between my intellect and my desire for the reader to have a good reading experience. And ultimately, I always go with the reader having a good reading experience. Between you and me and everybody who's listening, the Nazis would never have invaded at the time that I have them invade. I have them invade Norway, Denmark, and Ireland on the same day, and that just would not have happened. They were too far apart. They didn't have the resources. And in their plan, they were going to invade after they invaded France, which was many months later. So at first I really wanted to follow the actual blueprint, you know, and what would have made sense in that way. But ultimately, I decided, no, it would be easier for the readers to understand what's happening. It would be easier for me. It would be a better story if they just somehow magically had all the resources to invade all of these countries that are very far apart on the very same day.
That magic is the magic of the author's imagination, and it's very important in writing a book. One of the things that strikes me about this book is the crafting of the two sisters. And, you know, I think you do a great job of balancing out, you know, melancholy and misery at the thought of, you know, the Germans occupying Ireland. You know, it's a really awful kind of thought versus, you know, the Germans are out there, and we've got to get away from them. And what we have to deal with are, you know, punctilious, you know, somewhat ravenous, you know, rich people who may or may not want to help us. So talk about, you know, the dueling realities, and, you know, the ravenous rich versus the ravenous Nazis.
That's really an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about that, but you're completely right. The ravenous rich in Gabby's world, they are not really her relatives. They're sort of relative adjacent, but she goes to them for help. And also she kind of wants to reconnect with family. She's completely alone. She knows no one in Ireland, except she met these people once a very long time ago. And instead of helping her, and maybe they couldn't help her, really get back to America. They use her for their own needs. They need some help. They need somebody to work in the kitchen, and so they sort of get her to work for them for a pittance. And in the other reality, sort of the same thing happens. Sabine is going to the same manor house for the same reason, because she knows she'd once met these sort of distant relations. And but when she gets there, it's the Nazis who are in the manor house who end up, you know, using her as a housemaid and so forth. So yeah, in both cases, they're looking for something that they don't get. And they're kind of being used by people who are gobbling up everything in sight.
You know, you talked about memory, and it struck me, too, that memory has about as much, reason to exist as the other world. And that it's faulty. We remember what we want to, and we dig up those memories. They come back, you know, highly affected by whatever situation we're in now. So talk about the difference between Gabby's memory of her past and Sabine's memories of her past, and how each reacted to that past that we haven't seen, to have, you know, exhibit the different natures of their personalities and also the different natures of their worlds.
Well, there are a lot of different ways I think that happens. One way is embodied in their parents. They have these parents, they're both professors at Vassar College, and it's very unusual for a woman to be a professor, but Gabby and Sabine's mother was, and so is their father. And they had this sort of storybook love. They were really more interested in each other than they were in their children. And Gabby resents that. She always wanted more, and Sabine sort of emulates that. That's what Sabine is looking for. She thinks her parents were amazing, and she wants to have what they had. So there, she is definitely looking for that. And there are other differences as well, all having to do with what you think about what happened on a certain day. First, there was a huge hurricane, and for Gabby, when she remembers this hurricane back in Poughkeepsie, it was a moment of betrayal by her parents, and for Sabine, it was a moment of being protected by Gabby and her parents. So, you know, memories are not real. Memories are what
exactly
we make of them.
Yeah, everybody says they remember something. No, you don't. You're making it up.
Yeah. It's true. And we use memories to sort of shore up ideas that we have about our past or ourselves in our past.
Also about our present, too. I mean, our memories are, in a sense, future-directed. They're saying, well, I did this before, so I can do that now, and it's all okay. Or, you know, I'm able to do this now. One of the things you mentioned, I think that it's very interesting, is that both sisters are fish out of water, in that they're in France when they're captured, when things start to go south. Then they're in Ireland, but they're really American. So talk about, I think, you know, fish out of water twice.
Yeah, they're a fish out of water for sure. And they're trying to adapt and trying to figure out how to be in this world. And they have no idea, you know, how to do it. And obviously there are a lot of Irish characters in the novel itself. And when I finished writing the book, I thought, well, I better make sure I have the Irish part of it right. And I actually took it to a historian / journalist in Cork as a sort of cultural sensitivity reader. And he let me know all the things. Oh, nobody would ever say that. Or they would say this way, or they would say that way. And that was really helpful to get that perspective. But it was an education for me too about what was life like at that time and how is it different from American life in that time. And it's always interesting, I think, as a writer, it's very useful to be able to compare and contrast either characters or settings, lifestyles, because then you can really pull out, how these people lived before. How did Gabby live before, and how does she live now? And she notices the difference, so the readers can notice the difference.
When you were writing this, how much of the end did you know? And I think for me at least, in my ventures, I think that in a sense, it's really helpful for writers not to know what happens, because then what surprises you also is equally, if not more surprising to the reader. So as you approached this book, from the very beginning, it went through a lot of changes. Talk about how those changes affected your perception of where you were going to end up.
Oh yeah. Well, let's see. The book has gone through a number of facelifts, as you, if you care to call it that. And I really, as you say, I really did not know exactly where it was going to end up. So, in general, I think for me as a writer, I try to hold things very lightly. I have ideas, but I try not to be too attached to them, because the story might go in a different direction. And I have to, you have to be a little bit careful not to force your own previous ideas on what your manuscript is now, once the words are actually on the page. And so, as an example of this, and I'm not going to give anything away, but on the very first scene I wrote was the last scene, which was not, it did not end up being the last scene, but when all was said and done. But I wrote a scene in which one of the characters you see is as being pregnant. And I was like, huh, that's kind of interesting. I didn't know that I was going to write that. So I sort of held that lightly in my head the whole way through, every draft of the manuscript. I sort of held this idea of one of the characters in the last scene being pregnant. And I wasn't really sure if I was going to use that or not. It was sort of an end point, but also not an end point, if that makes any sense. It was a potential end point, I'll put it that way. And for the sake, I know you've read the ending, but for the sake of the listeners, I won't say whether or not that scene made its way into the book.
We were talking about memory before, and what you described was essentially, in a sense, how your own memory of how the book was supposed to end or supposed to start had changed. So I like to talk about the changes that you go through as an author writing a book, especially a book where, that you take a big leap into using an element of the fantastic with this the other world and the alternate history. That's a big deal. Is that something I'm guessing this is not something you've done a lot as a historical writer. You want to speak to history.
No, but actually, you're right. I've not done this before, but when I was in graduate school, quite a number of my first short stories had some magical realism to them. And this was number one. There wasn't a lot of magical realism going on at the time. It wasn't very popular unless you are, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And number two, quite frankly, I was not that good at it. So I had sort of this drive, this desire that I didn't. I thought I had sort of put it away for forever. And so I was a little surprised when I was trying to reinvent the novel that, We Meet Apart, that magical realism came back into the picture. I was surprised and delighted, because because it is really fun as well as challenging for me to write. And I write a lot about sisters. I come from a large Irish family. I have six sisters and no brothers. So I had this, I love to write about sister relationships. So that part I felt pretty confident about. And the other part, you know, making up a whole new world, that was daunting, but it also sounded like a lot of fun to me. I wanted to try it.
You know, fun is really an important part of the reading experience. And I thought, to be honest, I had a lot of fun reading about this alternate history. As a writer, one of the things that interests me is that, you know, you're very invested in the feelings of your sisters who are, you know, have for each other in the novel both. So talk about also you as a writer, when this book was going through changes, did you show it to other people or did how much influence do you think they had? I'm not saying that they had a lot, you know, that they told you to go one way or the other. I'd like you to talk about the state of your feelings about how other people felt about what that you are showing them and how that helped to change your own feelings.
Wow, that is a really deep, interesting question. I may not even be able to answer it on the fly, but I'm going to try. I think that for me, at least in the beginning, what I need when the manuscript is not finished, I need support. I need somebody to say, "This is interesting. Keep going." And I have my best friend. Lives in Chicago, and I always send her the manuscript first, and her only job is to say what confused her, what she didn't understand, and also to say, "I loved it, keep going," whether or not hopefully she really does love my work. But in the beginning, that's really all I need. I need some support, and I need somebody to tell me what was confusing to them. Because of course, when you're writing, it all makes sense to you. And you think you might have explained something, or you think you might not need to explain something that you need to explain better. So that's sort of my first stage. Then I have a bunch of beta readers who I know are on my side and who like my work and who will give me productive feedback in a constructive way. So I do think that as a writer, as a creative person, you have to be a little protective of the creative part of you because you want to nurture it. You want it to keep going. And you're always going to make mistakes at first, or even in the end, there might be things later on you wished you had done differently. But especially in the beginning, when you're still trying to form this creative project, you need to be careful about who you show it to and whose understanding and feedback will really help you. And finally, I do have a freelance editor that I use. And I always feel like she's a professional, and she also gets where I'm going, even if it's a very different book than the book before. So she's very good at helping me get to where I want to go.
You know, one of the things that interested me about this book also too was just in some the prose on the page on a prose level. It is very nice. It's really easy to read, but it also feels detailed, like you're really right there. Is this prose fall off the tip of your pen, or is it? Is it discovered somewhere between what falls off your pen and what ends up on the page?
Yes, I write beautiful, complete, perfect first drafts right at the get-go, and I never need to change anything, and I'm so lucky that way. No, I wish, I very much wish. I think that there are some There are definitely some scenes where it just works and I don't need to revise them too much. And then there are other scenes that I go over and over and over. I've come to learn that if I'm going over a scene too many times, it probably needs to be cut altogether, either because it's not taking the story in the right direction, or there's an inherent conflict that I don't really see, perhaps consciously, with something that happens later on or something that happened before, or an idea that will happen later on. So I would say that, there are certainly scenes that had beautiful lines that I thought were beautiful, not to toot my own horn, but that I ultimately had to cut because they weren't working.
As you're a writer who's interested in history, talk about, how much research you do to directly affect the prose on the page, and how much research you do because it enriches you as a writer and, you have more experience. Like, on one hand, it's nice to go on the internet and look up a bunch of stuff. On the other hand, it's very helpful for you as a writer to, treat yourself to a trip to Ireland and see it. I've been there. It's really beautiful. I'd love to go back. So talk about, the import of travel, writing from where you've traveled and your experience versus writing from what you've read.
Well, I definitely went back to Ireland two or three times for research, as research trips. And that was really a huge treat. And one of the times I went with my sister, one of my sisters, and that was just wonderful. And we didn't do any of the regular touristy things. We just went around to different big houses that you can tour and looked at the way, the other half lived, that sort of thing. So that was really fun. Of course, Ireland today is very different than Ireland in 1940. So there's always that piece where there's something missing when you actually go to the physical place. I, as I said before, I get a lot of inspiration just reading firsthand accounts of people who lived in the time and the place that I'm writing about. So I do a lot of that research up front before I really start writing the manuscript itself. And that gives me ideas for story and what comes next and sort of the unfolding of events. I always have a character or characters in mind, and I always know what they want, and I always know whether or not they will ultimately get what they want. When I do research about the actual people and the actual place, that helps me sort of fill in the setting, fill in the world. And as I say, it gives me ideas.
You just said that you always have a character in mind. I'd like you to talk about how much writing you do when you're sitting in front of the word processor, blank page, however you write, maybe talk about how that physical experience impacts you. But also, how much of your writing is essentially like seeding the clouds in your mind so that when you sit down in front of that word processor, you'll be able to rain upon the page exactly what you want, or at least a close approximation of what you want the story to be.
Yeah. I do a lot of just sitting and free writing on a pad of paper before I write something on the computer. And that sort of gives me a chance to play a little bit without feeling like, I've got to write a scene now. It's got to be, so many words, or I can't get up from my seat before it's done. And any creative project, begins with play. And I feel like that's a very important part of it. We get to play a little bit. So I do a lot of that. And then I put it into a scene. And I would say that I do revise an awful lot, but I try to always keep moving forward. So I remember reading once that Jane Smiley said she would read what she had written the day before, but nothing beyond that. And then she would start from there and write the next few pages. And I feel like that's a really good system for me as well, to just always try to keep moving forward, because otherwise you might get caught just endlessly revising, you know, the very first chapter, which I have also been known to do.
Do you write more than one thing at a time? While you're writing this, in the actual writing process, is there some other story that, you know, you're nascently developing? Are you seeing two clouds at once? And, or, you know, maybe you get rainfall from the next forthcoming novel, you put that down and go back to the one you're working on?
Well, it's funny that you should ask that, because a year ago or 2 years ago, I would have said I only work on one project at a time. Although that being said, I usually start to research another project while I'm still revising, you know, my last one. But now a friend of mine and I conceived of a sort of humorous thriller that we're trying to write together. And that's been a lot of fun and very different. I've never written with another person before. So just a few months ago, I thought, you know what, I'm going to put away the novel I've been working on and just write a few scenes from this sort of light, humorous thriller that we're doing together. And I found it sort of refreshing to just take a break. And then now I'm back to my regularly scheduled program. And actually, I find I have more energy for it. So I don't know, maybe it's a good thing to do.
Are you working on something now by yourself in addition to the humorous thriller, which I hope you'll tell me about when it comes? I want to read it.
Definitely. Yes, I'm writing something very different. It doesn't have any sort of magical realism or speculative component. It's historical fiction taking place. It's sort of a Norma Rae of 1820 New Hampshire. A woman lives in a small rural town and a cotton mill gets built and accidents begin to happen. And she's trying to protect herself and her family, and we'll see if she does.
It sounds like an excellent opportunity for you to bring a bit of reformation to the vision of the Luddites, who were often seen as anti-progress, but what they were was anti-being exploited, or at least that was a large part of what they were about.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, there's this idea of, you know, anything for consumerism, anything for capitalism, that, you know, is both a big idea and a small idea. So in my New Hampshire novel, it's a very small, you know, small idea, but it has larger ramifications.
Well, you know, that made me think that, you know, right now we're in the midst of a technological revolution, or at least we're told, yeah, this AI thing is going to be a big deal, you know, and I guess we're all expected to just step out of the way or what? I don't know. So I look forward to reading your novel about a cotton mill when it was a lot simpler to avoid.
Yeah, and you can sort of understand the different jobs, whereas the AI jobs now, you know, I have no idea sometimes what people are doing in this technologically advanced world of ours.
Learning to ask the right question, which has always been an important skill. So I look forward to reading your next novel. I've been speaking with Martha Conway. Her new novel is We Meet Apart, which I think has some implications for today's technology as well. Oh, thank you for joining me, Martha.
Thank you. This has been so much fun.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.